Hello, I'm Georgina Godwin and this is Monocle Reads. I have a couple of guests on this week's programme. The first is Christopher Maclehose, known as a leader in translated literature in the United Kingdom. The Edinburgh-born Maclehose is reported to have brought works into English from as many as 34 languages during his time as publisher of Harville Press from 1984 to 2004, and then from 2008, when he created Maclehose Press as an imprint of Quercus Books. Last year, he left his eponymous press at Quercus after 13 years to launch a new imprint, Mountain Leopard Press. This is also centred on translation, but includes some literary work written originally in English. One of the lead titles is The Earth Spinner. This is the fifth book by Indian novelist, journalist and editor Anuradha Roy. Her previous books are An Atlas of Impossible Longing, The Folded Earth, Sleeping on Jupiter and All the Lives We Never Lived. She joins us from Araniket in the Indian Himalayas. Thank you both so much for being here. It's wonderful to have you in person, Christopher, and for us both to speak to our dear friend Anuradha in India. Christopher, I want to start with your extraordinary life, because can I ask how old you are? Is that rude?
No, I don't think so. 81 now.
And you arrived at the studio on your motorbike, which I think is just impossibly glamorous. And indeed, that's your reputation. So I have to first address the apocryphal story. Is it true that you used to chuck your flat keys out of the window down to a waiting Marianne Faithful?
Dear, I'm sure it isn't.
Well, I've heard it from many sources, might I say.
I was at her wedding. That's as far as the story could go. I think it's that is as far as the story goes. Yeah.
Well, of course, you are married to the fantastic Kukla, and she is one of the people that really inspires your love of translated fiction. Tell me how you began this, because I know you started really on newspapers.
It's true. I was looking after the book pages on The Scotsman for 3 years in the 60s, and under a benign editorship, it was possible to review books in other languages and to publish serious academic work about the modern literatures of post-war France, Italy, Germany, and so on. And nobody stopped me doing that. So I went on, and when I became a publisher, it was still in a time when the best publishing, I think, in London was being done by the émigré figures, Leopold Ulstein, Fred Warburg, Weidenfeld, and so on, who had come mostly from Europe and for whom the study of and the translation and publishing of great works from Europe and elsewhere was completely normal. It is less so now, but it is being done valiantly mostly by tiny independent publishers.
And is that because literature and translation is thought not to be saleable?
That's right. It has that reputation. The facts are otherwise. Many of the great best-selling writers of today are crime writers in translation from Scandinavia, famously from France and elsewhere. So that has changed the habit. Once Henning Mankell and Stieg Larsson became bestsellers, publishers, because they were all sheep, set off Scandinavia and collected almost anybody who could write a crime story. And so there's a great number of them now in England, successfully, I'm happy to say.
Now, of course, you are the person that discovered Stieg Larsson. Tell us about that.
I didn't discover him at all. He was about to be published in Sweden, his native country, very soon after he died. The Swedish publisher brought two huge typescripts, which had already been translated and which had been miraculously turned down by 18 publishers, to my house in London, and said, almost pleadingly, would you please read these and see if you could translate them? Of course, it wasn't a problem to do that at all. The text needed to be not retranslated, but re written into English. It had been translated by an American. But everybody who read that trilogy, and I think in our editions in England there were more than 13.5 million of them, would tell you, how could anybody read these and fail to want to publish them? It's astonishing still to me.
What do you think the success of those particular books was? Is it Elizabeth Salander, the heroine of the trilogy?
She's one in 28 million. She's an extraordinary creation. And Stieg Larsson can tell a story like almost nobody else in modern times. I loved the works of Henning Mankell and his police inspector, Wallander. But they're not quite at the same level of electrifying suspense that Larsson developed.
Now, it's not just writers from Scandinavia, but from all over the world. I mean, for instance, you've published Haruki Murakami too.
This is true, yes. At a time, blessedly, when that lovely man, fine storyteller, had been abandoned by another English house. So that was a pleasure and equally obvious. And he goes on and on writing books which are very well sold in this country.
He's an extraordinary writer. I did an event about him, sadly not with him, a little while ago, and as somebody was reading, I think it was from the Wind-Up Bird Chronicles, two members of the audience fainted. That's how powerful he is.
Well, I'm not amazed, and I can imagine not one but two separate incidents in the book that would have brought that about, perhaps one each. I went to a summer festival once on a tiny island off Denmark to celebrate the works of Murakami. He and his wife were there. The place was packed. It was so far packed that the audience had to be one audience in the morning on day one, a completely different audience in the afternoon, and the same on the second day. So that, all that many Danes came to listen to this, remarkable international figure.
Now, we briefly mentioned your wife at the top of the programme, and she is French, she speaks Greek, she speaks Italian, Spanish, and of course English. She's invaluable to what you do. I mean, you are a very strong partnership in this.
This is true. Her Greek is deplorable, but she left Greece, where she was born, when she was five, I think, and she says she's forgotten most of it. I was there once in Greece with her, and she spoke fluently to everybody, sang fluently to everybody as well. Yes, she reads all day and all night and is invaluable.
And, of course, you listen to her opinion. You also listen to opinions of some of your other authors, people like Umberto Eco.
Who couldn't? Who wouldn't? Yes, you do. I think every publisher will seek to depend upon the wisdom. For example, Eco and other distinguished Italian writers, you would go to and you would say what you're actually asking them is, would they like to share their publishing house in England with this new writer? And as long as you don't tell anybody what they say, they are willing to say, I think I'd rather not. and you listen to that.
Yeah. Now, you've had this extraordinary career, which you've just reinvented yet again. At 80, you start a completely new publishing house. Why is that?
I had been very happily with the Hachette Group in London, and they're a huge and welcoming body, a great publishing house. But it seemed, for all kinds of reasons, to be time to set off in a direction where I could be more independent. And under the Welbeck Publishing Group, several hundred yards only from here, that is what I have managed to achieve.
What's the mandate of Mountain Leopard Press?
And owing much to Anna Rudder and her distinguished publisher husband, Rukun Advani, for the name and the direction. They published together a list called Permanent Black. And my original plan was to call my list Permanent Red, but Rukun pointed out that that would not be a good sound. He has always, in all his independent years of publishing, getting on for 20 now, been in the black. I would no doubt have always been in the red, but Mountain Leopard Press is safer in that regard. So it just to be independent under the shoulder of the Welbeck Group, which is run by the man who ran Quercus, Mark Smith. That was a very satisfactory arrangement with him in those years, and we've re-established it.
So I want to bring in Anuradha now, who's been listening very patiently. Anuradha, your very first book was published by Christopher.
Yes, he did. He published that book when, as he described with Stieg Larsson, I had given up hope of that book ever finding a publisher because it had been turned down countless times. And I happened to meet Christopher at I think it was the British Council and a London Book Fair event. And I asked him if he would read my book. And he took 50 pages home. And then he came back and said he'd like to read the rest of it. And then what followed was really the pattern for all my books, which is that he reads them in such a miraculous fashion that he is able to see many possibilities I don't. So publishers and authors are often friends, but I would be lost without him, which is why when he left to start Mountain Leopard Press, I was just following the best publisher in the world.
Christopher, do you remember first meeting and reading Anuradha?
I do. It was, as she describes, a British Council event at the very beginning of the London Book Fair, a rather busy time, and she emerged from a crowd, I think holding on to a typescript, and said, not expecting any difficulty at all, would you mind reading this book immediately? And I said, well, I would happily read 30 or 40 pages before the following Tuesday when we would meet. And they were so good. You couldn't believe that anybody, publishers or agents or whoever, could possibly have failed to see the quality in it. Anybody should read An Atlas of Impossible Longing. They'll have the same reaction.
And that's it. The extraordinary thing about you is that you are able to see the potential in books that other people have passed over. Before we talk about Anuradha's latest novel, I just wanted to talk about your first publication briefly, because you've already come out with a book. It's called Beirut 2020. And I mean, this is a very fast turnaround because it's about the port explosions.
It was published very swiftly in France by Actes Sud, bought by an American publisher who was living in France at that time, picked it up at once and recognized in the description of Sharif Majdalani a very remarkable journal of the months leading up to the day, August 4th last year, of the catastrophe, which was the explosion, as you say, in the port of Beirut, which horror has by no means yet been repaired. We published the book on the anniversary, and I think it's necessary to read. It's a very, very fine, moving memoir.
And that was your first title. And this one now, The Earth Spinner, is to be published this month. Now, it's about, I believe, two people struggling to free themselves of shackles to create a happier world. Anuradha, is that how you would describe it? What would you say about your book?
Yes, that partly describes it, because there are quite a few interconnected themes in the book. But I think the main thing the book is about is that it dramatizes the death, I think, of liberal India.
And it's set between India and England, although you never actually specifically name the places. Why is that?
I just like the freedom of making up places. It's really quite simple, because the place, it's set in two places. One is a sort of slightly disadvantaged locality in South India, which has a semi-rural part and an urban part, which is where the potter at the center of the book lives. And there is this girl, Sara, who is the girl who travels to England, and England is mentioned, but not her university. She goes there to study. And really, the novel takes place between these two countries, and in some ways, placing them in these two countries gives a kind of fluidity to the characters, because the Sarah, when she comes to England, discovers through the kind of slight racism and isolation she faces that someone quite privileged in India is, it's a whole different thing for her when she moves. And the novel is really about interconnectedness between classes, between countries, and the possibilities of these which are being snuffed out in India at the moment.
Now, I know that two of your personal passions are pottery and dogs, and both of those make an appearance, or more than an appearance. They are big themes in the book.
Yes, yes. I've always wanted to write a book with a dog at the centre, which is not a cutesy book about a dog. You know? So here the dog is a very serious, pivotal character, in fact, who brings together people, who establishes network, who is the spring for most of the action. And he is the person who brings Sarah together closer with Ilango, who's a potter who lives in a slum. And normally she would not have, gone to his house as much or been as close to him as she does become. And they have a very complex relationship, which is more than that of a teacher and student or two neighbors or something of that kind. And it's a relationship that really, you know, if you think of D.H. Lawrence, who looks at sex as the kind of thing that can leap across class and unite Lady Chatterley with the gardener, here it's art, it's pottery, that whole, the creativity of pottery, which is a passion with both Sarah and Ilango, that makes the two of these people connect across caste and class and income level. And the dog is the person who brings them together.
Is it difficult to write the character of a dog? Is it entirely different from writing about humans?
I knew that I didn't want the dog to, speak or be made I do it to my own dogs all the time. I imagine what they are saying and doing and so on. But here I wanted him very much to be an animal, to be an animal who, in the hierarchy of things in India, particularly, a dog is probably at the bottom of the heap. So I wanted this dog to claim the space of this, of being an animal who is honored and loved and has courage and makes things happen in the book.
Christopher was smiling when I mentioned the dog. Why is that, Christopher?
The dog is, as Anuradha says, genuinely the spring for much of the action. But he makes so many things happen, and the final scenes of that dog are so moving. People will remember him forever. He's a central character. He absolutely does not intrude, if you like, in what is the literature of the narrative, but he is essential to everything that happens in the Indian part of the book. He's a charming person.
Or dog.
Yes.
Or dog.
Yes.
The Horse of Flames and the Dream. Tell us a little bit more about that, Anuradha.
Well, the horse is a terracotta horse that the potter wants to build. And this is he wants to build this horse, and he has dreamed of it. And it is something that he recognizes comes from a very primitive mythical part of his background. The horse exists in Hindu mythology as a very powerful symbol. And earthen horses are still built in South India as an annual festival, which happens towards the end of the year every year. But in this case, this man is building this horse because he wants to offer it as a gift to the woman he loves, who is a Muslim woman. And in the process, this sacred horse becomes sort of secular. And he invites the woman's grandfather, who is an Urdu calligrapher, a blind man, to carve Arabic verses on his horse. And so this horse actually becomes a symbol of the effort to heal all the divisions that have that have erupted in India the past many years. What actually had happened was, I mean, for us, when we were much younger, in about 92, there was this catastrophic and gigantic destruction of a mosque in India. It was broken down because it was meant to have been built on a Hindu sacred site, the Babri Masjid. And this happened in about 92 when I was in my 20s. And it was like a hammer blow. It really felt as if the state had completely abandoned us to the forces of fundamentalism. And that happened long ago. But I think that is what the horse symbolizes in the book, this absolute destruction of the way we used to live together in harmony here, where there's a lot of diversity in this country. And it was always, always a place where secularism was the goal.
And do you think that you're seeing that happening again?
Well, now we've really lost that harmony for good, I think.
Mm. Christopher, you have edited all of Anuradha's books so far. Where does this one sit within her canon?
Very interesting to reflect on that. I find that each book is absolutely distinct from its predecessor. They're set in different parts of India, and elsewhere. And yes, you recognise the hand of Anuradha, but it's astonishing how, almost without any sense of research having been undertaken, you find yourself deeply immersed in quite different parts of modern Indian society and historical Indian society, as this one, almost created by a different writer.
Mm. And of course, this is not actually a book in translation. Anuradha, you write in English.
I read in Bengali, but Bengali is my mother tongue, and I read in it, but I've never written in it. I've translated from it for the last book, which had sections from a novel written by a Bengali writer. But I've never written in any other language but English. And as Christopher says, each of the books really does. I mean, now if I look back, the first one was probably centrally about caste, and the second one centrally about the environment, because it was set in the Himalayas and it was very much about the destruction of the forests. And the third one, Sleeping on Jupiter, was about sexual violence against women. You and I talked about that at the Hay Festival. That was the first time we talked about a book together.
Indeed. And in fact, we've also recorded an episode of our Meet the Writers program where we go into your career and all of your works in some detail. So I would refer listeners to that to hear more. What happens next then? What happens for Zara in the book and for you?
Well, I don't know. I feel completely, after each book, absolutely hollowed out, as though everything's been emptied out, and I'm not writing a line, which will not reassure Christopher in the least at the moment. I'm just making pots. I've been making them for years, but now I'm almost full-time doing that and cover designs for Permanent Black, which we run, Rukun and I, together from Ranikhet.
And did you do the cover design of The Earth Spinner?
No, that's done by a very gifted Colombian designer called Monica Reyes, who Christopher discovered, and she's done each of the books. And she each time has such an incredible ability to unite text to an image that really gathers up many of the themes. And she often makes these things. She made an actual clay horse and then photographed it for this cover.
And on the inside, there's a technical term for this page, isn't there, Christopher? What's it called?
The end papers.
On the end papers, is this Bengali script?
No, it's Urdu. It's Urdu calligraphy. And what it is the original of the epigraph.
We're out of time, which is so sad because I could talk to both of you forever. Christopher, what next for Mountain Leopard Press?
We are publishing books in translation from, I think it's now, 9 languages. And the next one is an early novel by the great Colombian writer Evelio Rosero. And after that, an account of the astonishing actual journey of little Amal which goes on today from the Syrian-Turkish border and ends in Manchester in November, and Little Amal the Puppet is, interestingly, today in Athens.
It's an extraordinary project, that, an artist's creator welcome for her wherever she arrives, don't they?
Yes, absolutely. Many children do.
And she will indeed be coming to London. She'll make her way here by the end. It's a 6,000-kilometre journey or something
like
that.
I think it's 8,000 steps.
Yeah, quite an amazing project. So, Christopher, we can look forward to much more coming from Mountain Leopard Press. And Anuradha, your book, obviously published by Christopher, people should look out for it. It's called The Earth Spinner, and it's by Anuradha Roy. Both of you, Christopher McElhose, Anuradha Roy, thank you so much for joining me on the programme.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Monocle Reads, thanks to the production team of Louis Allen and Laura Hull. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.